Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Crime and Coffee Couple. My name's Allison.
And my name's Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, Al. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Oh, good, good. Thanks for asking.
You're so welcome.
Yeah.
Anytime.
Yeah. Hey, welcome to the Crime and Coffee Couple. As we said before, Allison, Mike, we're a couple, married couple, coming at you every Sunday with new episodes. And then we have bonus episodes for all of our Patreons and Apple subscription folks. Once a week, at least.
Once a week.
So four times a month.
Yes.
How about that? That's
eight episodes a month, including bonus episodes.
We're
very awkward together.
Yeah.
But if you're new to us, I tell the story. Mike has no idea what the topic is, so he's reacting and hearing it just like you guys are.
And in general, Mike has no idea what's going on, so it kind of works out.
Damn clue.
Yeah, it's nice. I see people like commenting sometimes, like, Mike wouldn't remember this at all, because they're starting to figure out that I really have no memory.
Yeah.
So
especially with crime.
How I hold a job, I have no idea. So hopefully some of my coworkers are listening to this right now.
You do good.
Yeah, thank you. So, had a good week so far this week. I came into the house the other day, and Allison was going through some payment that she had to make for her skin cancer thing that is gone now, so she's all good. But she got one of the bills, and she's looking at it, and she's like, okay. And I see her, like, writing a check. I was like, why are you writing a check? Like, who writes checks now?
Okay, and in full disclosure, in our household tasks, Mike pays the bills, so I don't normally pay bills. And mind you, I'm not a moron. I don't normally write a freaking check. But I was like, anytime you go to these websites, there's all these loops you have to jump through, or hoops. Loops or hoops, regardless. You're jumping through them.
Either way.
I'm like, whatever. I'm just going to stick a check in the mail and call it a day.
Well, like, you got to, like, usually make an account or something.
It's yeah.
Like, you don't want to be bothered with that.
I don't want to be bothered with anything.
I'm not saying, like, everybody. I'm saying you specifically.
I do not. I have no bandwidth for
okay.
it.
Okay. So you're writing a check?
Yes, I'm writing a check.
And so she's writing it. I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, it's just easier. I'm like, is it easier to write a check, fold up the envelope, walk out to the but put a stamp on it, because God knows they're not paying for it.
Right.
Walk out to the post office, you know, box, the mailbox, put it in there, wait for it to be taken.
Raise the flag.
You got to put the flag up. That's a lot of work.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So I'm like, that's easier than just like calling. I'm sure they have a billing department or something.
There was no call. It was a website.
So I'm like, okay, that's fine. Well, you already did it, so may as well put it in the mail. So she closes it up, licks it. And puts it shut and looks at the address. She's like, oh, am I supposed to put their address in the upper left corner? I'm like, no, that's where our address
goes. I'm not a moron. And mind you, it was after 10 hours of working on a Friday. I know how to address an envelope,
Sounds
people.
Like excuses
I promise you I do. We write out about 80 Christmas cards a year. I know how letters work. I wasn't thinking.
Okay, so she properly filled us out in the return address side. And the only reason you asked that is because you couldn't see an address to send it to. Because, you know, like with those bills, you got to like put them in such a way so that
it's in the screen or whatever.
Yeah, you can see it. So clearly you didn't do it right.
Through the window.
So, yeah, so she has to rip it open and like finagle it so that it's in the right position. But you couldn't.
No, we
like,
had no tape.
Oh, yeah.
So we had no glue sticks.
Yeah, there's nothing to secure this thing.
The glue in our house wasn't working either. So I was literally, I opened the Elmer's glue, stuck my finger in the bottle.
I didn't see that.
And then painted it on the place where you lick it.
Yeah.
It was just a hot mess. It wasn't my finest moment.
Yeah.
I wasn't proud of it. So of course my husband has to share it across the airwaves so that everyone thinks, oh my gosh, this girl's a friggin' idiot.
Hey, at the very least, even if you don't like our content, like share this with other people so they can laugh and enjoy of Allison's, you know, just
well, I have something to share about you.
Wait, were we totally done with that? No, I ended up taking it out of the envelope and then calling them and paying
No,
them.
You did not call
oh, no,
them.
It was
I went to the website. You yanked my phone out of my hand. So don't give yourself too much credit here.
Let's remember, you couldn't find the bill number.
No, because it was hidden.
It was in the middle of the paper.
I don't have patience for that.
It said bill number and it was right under where it said bill number.
It took a while for you to
it
find
did,
it too.
I will agree.
So Mike's story, because as high and mighty as he thinks he is, he's not. I walk into our bedroom yesterday and I see a trail of blood.
Oh my God.
That is leading from his side of the bed to his sink. So it's like, if you were a criminal, we know who the culprit was because the evidence is right there.
Being a true crime podcast, that definitely pops up.
So I yell out to Mike and I'm like, are you bleeding somewhere? I'm like, I think this is blood. I'm like, there's drips of blood all the way from your bed to the sink. So Mike comes in, he's like, huh? And then he flips the bedding on his side of the bed, and there's like a huge spot of blood at the end of the bed.
I'm like, oh yeah, that's probably related to this.
So he had gotten new shoes and wore them to the point that they wore the skin completely off the back of his heel, where he had an open wound, which, why didn't you put a Band-Aid on?
I think we're out of Band-Aids too.
No, so we're like, not out of Band-Aids.
This whole house is falling apart outside
of the
podcast.
We're going to shits. Yeah. I'm telling you, we've...
So I have really weird feet and I usually get sores and I don't really care if I do. So like whatever, if I bleed, I bleed. Right. So I just happen to be bleeding and now my socks are stuck to the back of my ankles because there's open wounds on both of them.
And
so,
we do have Band-Aids.
Yeah, we do. And then my dog was licking off the blood off my feet.
So she was licking the blood off the floor. I'm like, this house has gone to hell.
Yeah, it looked like somebody was like, I don't
murdered.
Know. Yeah,
basically. You're a weirdo. I'm looking at your knee right now. There's like a flap of skin hanging off because you were helping our son pitch. So you were catching.
I was catching. And instead of squatting, I just figured I'd kneel the whole time. And as I was kneeling and catching, I was like, oh man, there's like I keep stepping on a stone or like kneeling on a stone. And I looked and there was like nothing there. I'm like, okay, whatever. I just put my knee back in the dirt. And then I get up and like look down. I'm like, oh, there's like a leaf on me. And I go to wipe it off. And it was my skin flapping in the wind. I was like, oh, nice. So I have an open wound in the dirt, which was bad.
Covered in clay. It's just really gross.
Yeah.
Don't you feel pain? Do you not know that that hurts?
I feel it. It felt really bad, but what am I going
to
do?
Under no circumstances would I be taking a walk and get to the point where the back of my socks are saturated in blood because I'd be complaining the entire time.
Oh, you would.
The second it started to hurt me, you'd know about it.
Yeah. And I'm the person that bleeds through the shoes and you wouldn't even know.
Yeah, no, I'm a complainer and Mike isn't.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm dumb and Mike is smart.
No, you're much smarter than I am. Actually, we're about the same smartness, I'd say.
That's what we got out of this conversation.
Yeah. Hey, we fill each other's holes.
We finish each other's sandwiches.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
I actually have a suggestion from Allison's Amazon addiction.
Hey, that's you.
It's me, and I'm wearing it. So if you're over at YouTube watching this video, you could see what it looks like. There's all sorts of different colors. Mine's like a light gray. But because I did have that skin cancer issue, I'm just being like hyper vigilant about sun protection. And my coworker suggested this to me. It's extremely lightweight. So it's not really for warmth as much as it is for sun protection.
Yeah, it's not for warmth.
Well, I will tell you, though, we were at our son's baseball game earlier this morning. I think it was like 58 degrees, and I was comfortable in it.
Nice.
But it's good because obviously we live in Florida, but if you're anywhere in the summer, it tends to get hot. So it's good because it's breathable, but it's like an SPF 50. It's got like the keyhole for your finger, so it covers the majority of your hands. And then it's got a hood attached to it, which I could feel the sun like beating on the side of my face slash my ear, which is where I had the skin cancer. Despite the fact that I do wear sunscreen, I still want that added layer of protection. So I know people in my neighborhood must think I'm kind of strange because I have my huge hat that protects my face plus this jacket.
In addition to everything else.
I mean, there's many reasons why people might find me strange, but that specifically, but it is very comfortable. And we were kind of chatting while we were walking. I said, I really never suggest anything on the Amazon addiction unless I've tried it and I like it.
Yeah, we're not getting paid by this brand.
No.
We might make a couple cents if you buy it through our links that's in the show notes.
It's more just me sharing something.
Anything we talk about in Allison's Amazon addiction is something we thought was worth bringing up.
Yeah. And speaking of that, you know, if you want to come over and see what it looks like on YouTube, speaking of YouTube, we are trying to grow that platform.
Yep. We've got over 1,000 subscribers. So come on over and be another one. And numbers coming from YouTube. So thank you for getting out there. We appreciate it.
We appreciate it. All right. So you ready to jump into this?
I'm ready.
All right, so let's do this. So this is the case of the Hollywood Ripper. I personally had never heard this story, so I wanted to research it. So it was the early morning hours of Saturday, August 14th, 1993, and Rick Picaccio was up early and he grabbed his cup of coffee. He had just stepped outside to walk the family dog when he noticed something just caught out of the corner of his eye. He saw two tennis shoes sticking up by the side door. He looked further and realized that his 18-year-old daughter, Trisha Lynn Picaccio, was splayed out on the stoop of the side door of their home.
Splayed?
Like
cut open?
No, like, you know, like laid
laying
out.
There.
Yes.
Okay.
So Rick dropped his coffee cup and ran to his daughter and saw that she had been stabbed to death at their Glenview, Illinois home.
Holy cow. Imagine finding your daughter stabbed to death on your own doorstep.
I actually had dreams about this case last night. Mm-hmm. So Rick tried in vain to revive his daughter. And in the meantime, Trisha's brother Doug woke up to the sound of a blood-curdling scream from his father as Rick screamed out for him to call 911. After the police arrived, Rick had the horrific task of calling his wife, Diane, to break the devastating news that their baby girl was gone. So when he called his wife, he didn't tell her exactly what had happened. He only said to Diane that she needed to come home because Trisha had been hurt. So Diane pulls in, and by that time, the officers are already there. And when she arrived, an officer basically had to tackle Diane as she screamed and ran to her daughter in order to prevent her from seeing her own daughter in that condition. And they were both so traumatized and devastated that they had to go to the hospital to be treated for shock. So the medical examiner later determined that Trisha had been stabbed at least a dozen times in a murderous frenzy. There were deep wounds to her heart, lungs, abdomen, collarbone, and back. Her left arm was fractured and proved that Trisha had fought her killer before she died. Tissue was found under Trisha's nails from an unknown person, so they took clippings of her fingernails. And because DNA technology was still in the early stages, really, at that point, the samples were not useful to the case. Mm. So they couldn't pinpoint the killer. There were no indications of any sexual assault, although police had this feeling that there was still sexual motivation to the murder.
Because of how many times she was stabbed?
Yeah.
Like a, what do they call that?
Overkill.
Yeah. Yeah,
I know what you're saying. Yeah. Sometimes when you put these headsets on and get in front of a microphone, like everything goes out of your brain.
No, you're good.
Because I'll be listening to a case and I can fill in the words and they're like, oh, I can't think of it. So anyway, as police started their investigation, they learned that Trisha was an amazing student. She was her parents' pride and joy. Everyone that spoke with the police about Trisha had nothing but positive words to say about her. Trisha was devoted to her high school sweetheart. She was someone who stayed out of trouble. Rick and Diane could not wrap their heads around who would possibly have done this to her, because this wasn't just like a normal murder. It was like a frenzy. And again, it happened right on the porch of their home. So it was saying a lot.
Yeah.
And she didn't have any enemies, so they just couldn't figure out how this could have happened. She was exceptionally responsible. She really never did anything to put herself in harm's way. And her parents basically always knew where she was, who she was with, what she was doing. They never truly needed to worry about her. Of course, they did as parents, but you know what I mean.
And how old did you say she was?
18. Okay. So there was no robbery, there was no sexual assault, and the brutality of the crime indicated that it was very personal. It was rage-fueled. Trisha had only recently graduated from high school, probably early June, end of May. She spent the last night of her life participating in a scavenger hunt with her friends. It was basically their last hurrah before they all went off to college, and I believe they were set to go to college like the next week, because, mm-hmm. you know, this is August.
Yeah.
So the group ended the night at a restaurant. I think they went to TGI Fridays, and after they ate, they just hung out in the parking lot and talked, because they knew everyone was going to go their separate ways after that. So then Trisha dropped a couple of her friends off at their houses, and police believe it was right around 1 a.m. based on, you know, witness accounts, her friends saying when they were dropped off, that she would have walked toward the side door of her house. She had her keys in her hand because they were right by her body when they found her. As she approached the door of her home, the killer grabbed her left arm, twisting it and breaking it, and then stabbed her 12 times in what was known as a blitz attack. Despite the fact that a neighbor within their cul-de-sac was hosting a pool party that night, no one reported hearing anything out of the ordinary. So police assumed that the killer had immediately stifled Trisha's screams as she was attacked. Trisha was a self-motivated girl who knew exactly what she wanted out of life. She was set to start her freshman year, where she planned to study engineering at Purdue University, when her life was tragically ended. She was the older sister to a 17-year-old brother named Doug and a 13-year-old brother named Tommy, and many considered her to be one of the most energetic, positive people that they had ever met. Somebody you just want to be friends with and be around. Mm-hmm. as investigators spoke with neighbors to determine if they had seen or heard anything on the night of Trisha's murder, the police kept hearing one name come up time and time again. And this was the name of 17-year-old Michael Gargiulo, who had the reputation of being a bully. He had a very short temper. He had issues with self-control. Somebody said it was like a switch. He could literally be fine one second and be in a rage the next. And you'd never knew what was going to set him off. On the flip side, he was also known to be charming when he wanted to be. He lived with his parents and siblings only five houses down from the Picaccios. Despite the Picaccio family always welcoming their children's friends into the home, because of course they have a home with three teenagers, I'm sure it's Grand Central Station when it comes to friends coming in and out, they were always so welcoming to the friends. If somebody wanted to stay for dinner on a whim, they could. But they always found that Michael seemed socially awkward and uncomfortable when visiting. Despite the others who would kind of settle in at the kitchen table and start eating, he was like a caged animal when he was visiting, pacing around, and Diane would be like, aren't you going to eat? And he'd like, no, gotta go. You're so like, huh. They never got close to him.
Yeah.
So after Trisha's murder, he began sending the family very random gifts. They found it odd rather than endearing.
Yeah, because he was never really close to them.
Since they really barely knew him.
Okay.
So when Michael was brought in for questioning, he did admit that he knew the Picaccio family. There was no denying that. He was friends with Trisha's brother, Doug. And he and Trisha attended Glenbrook South High School together at the same time.
Real quick. So you said this is the Hollywood Ripper and we're in Glenview, Illinois.
We'll get there.
Okay. I just want to make sure everybody listening is thinking the same thing I am.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll get there. Right now we're in Illinois. We're in the Midwest. We will go to Hollywood, California.
Interesting. Okay.
So he, again, they did attend high school together. By no means was Trisha friends with Michael. She obviously knew him.
Why was he at their house? Like just hanging out with the same people, basically?
Her younger brother, Doug, who was only slightly younger than her, he was 17, he would hang out with Michael. So because there was no proof, though, that Michael played any role in what happened to Trisha, he was free to go. After Trisha's murder, the family could not bear to live in the home where Trisha had been brutalized, so they moved out. They kept the house. They moved out for 4 years. They went to stay with Diane's mother until they eventually decided that it was time to come back home. Shortly after the return, it was a fall day in 1998, and they had an unexpected visitor when Michael knocked at the side entrance of the home. Michael told Diane that he wanted to speak with Rick. He was told Rick is at work, so he asked if he could wait. And he ended up sitting at the kitchen table for over an hour as he waited for Rick to come home from work. Again, this is strange because Diane described him as a caged animal at their house. He was really only ever there for 5-10 minute intervals, and this time he's sitting at the kitchen table waiting. So that was out of the ordinary. So then when Rick walked in from work, he recalls Michael having a look on his face as if he wanted to say something. Before he had a chance to speak, though, Michael's father and one of his sisters arrived. They did not even bother to knock on the door. They basically came in the house uninvited and told Michael, we gotta go. And they grabbed him and they left.
And like, these aren't like friends of theirs or anything,
no.
Right? They just know Michael obviously as their son. So they're okay. So something's up.
So Rick and Diane were speechless. They believe that Michael may have had something to do with their daughter's murder. And this was really the last time they ever saw him. So Rick and Diane spoke to authorities about this incident, but by that time it was too late and Michael had disappeared. As time went by, Trisha's parents, Rick and Diane, were warned by Cook County Police that some murders do go unsolved. They're like, there's no guarantee that we are going to find this person.
Yeah, they're like, look at this list. We've got stacks of papers that are unsolved.
So Diane refused to believe, though, that her daughter could possibly be attacked and murdered literally on their door stoop of their house and get away with it.
Especially, like, not randomly. You know, it's somebody they know. It's definitely somebody they know. I have 99% chance.
Right.
It seems like Michael.
So the case soon grew cold, and a decade would pass before a suspect was identified. But in the meantime, other victims would sadly lose their lives. So soon after Michael left Chicago, he headed 2,000 miles away to Los Angeles, California, with a dream of getting into acting, as so many people moved to California to do so. He was actually hired to play the role of a boxer named Rocco in a film called Boxing's Been Good to Me.
Rocco. Yeah. Not too close to Rocky.
So it was created by a USC film school student. And during this time, he was known to be surrounded by women. He was a clean-cut, muscular, good-looking guy. After his acting career hit a wall, Michael went on to work as a bouncer at a nightclub. He then moved on to heating and cooling, like the air conditioning cooling business. Mm. He was the kind of guy who tried to make himself a lot bigger than he actually was. Like, he was a big shot, but he wasn't. And it's always the ones that talk themselves up the most that aren't.
Yeah, and it's always the same thing in like in my line of work, like sales. The people that say that they're in charge and the ones that make the decisions, it's almost never that person. It's always a guy sitting in the corner that's not really saying anything.
Yeah. So he loved to control and impress people. So now we're moving on to February of 2001, and this was about 7.5 years after Trisha was murdered. So this is 22-year-old Ashley Ellerin, and she was living in the Hollywood Hills of California. She was splitting her time between classes at the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising during the day while spending her nights working at a gentleman's club. She chose this line of employment because the money was right, it paid. Yeah. And obviously it's not cheap to live in California, and it allowed her to afford her bungalow where she lived with a roommate. Ashley was described as an amazing woman. She was gorgeous, fun, spontaneous, the life of every party. She made friends with basically anybody that she met. So when Ashley wasn't consumed with school and work, she spent time with a new boyfriend, and this just so happened to be an up-and-coming actor from That 70s Show. Hmm. And this is Ashton Kutcher.
Oh.
So the two had met through friends in December of 2000, and the relationship was new. It still was more of a friendship than anything else at this point. It was early days. They had only truly gone out a couple of times. In a few of my articles, I was reading that she was known to date other celebrities like Vin Diesel and Vince Vaughn.
Wow.
So when Ashley wasn't consumed with school and work, I already read that part. So now we're moving on to the night of February 21st, 2001. And Ashton and Ashley had plans to get together that night. But because Ashton was running late, he continued to push his arrival time back. At 8:24 p.m., Ashton called and spoke with Ashley, who had just gotten out of the shower. She told him she was going to get ready to blow dry her hair. He arrived at her home at 10:45 p.m. He saw that her red BMW was parked outside. All of the lights were on inside the house, but he knocked twice at the door and there was no answer. He tried the lock. It was locked. He peered through the window. The house looked a mess, but this wasn't unusual because they were doing some renovations inside, so he didn't think anything of that. He turned the doorknob again. It was locked. So he made the assumption that Ashley would be upset with him because he was running later than he had initially told her, and that maybe she had just kind of blown him off and gone on with her own night.
Sure. And he's like, I'll give her some space.
Yeah. So he also looked through the window of the house. He saw no sign of Ashley. He did see a maroon colored stain near the entrance of Ashley's bedroom. He just made the assumption that it must have been wine that had gotten spilled. He left Ashley's apartment that night, or I shouldn't say apartment, her house that night, without ever going inside. Ashley's roommate, Jennifer DeSisto, came home the next morning at about 9 a.m. She had spent the night at her boyfriend's house, and she was met with a horrific sight. As she headed back toward her own bedroom, she came upon Ashley's body. It was lying just outside the bathroom door across two stairs, covered in blood. She was wearing a turquoise terry cloth robe, silk boxer shorts, and a camisole. Jennifer was shocked. She was hysterical and terrified. She ran from the house, and she was thinking that it was possible that the killer could still be in there.
Sure.
She jumped in her car, and then that's when she called 911. When the paramedics arrived, Ashley was pronounced dead at 9:28 a.m., and the case was handed over to the coroner. When an autopsy was done, it revealed that Ashley had been stabbed 47 times.
Jeez, that's a lot. I mean, just to think doing that, like just moving your arm 47 times. That's a lot.
It's insane.
Much less killing somebody with a knife and like stabbing in their body.
I mean, whoever did this had to have been in a blind rage.
Yeah.
So that she was stabbed with such viciousness that the blade of the knife in certain parts of her body had actually exited the other side.
Wow.
And 12 of the wounds alone were considered fatal. There was a deep wound to her neck that was so brutal that her head had almost been severed. Her spinal cord was the only thing keeping her attached. I mean, this was absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
Her hands and arms were covered in slash marks that were deduced to be defensive wounds. Like Trisha, there was no evidence of sexual assault. Police deduced that Ashley had been attacked from behind just after she had taken a shower. There was a struggle in the area right outside the bathroom. Jennifer could not imagine who would have done such a thing to an amazing person like Ashley, and it was her belief that Ashley must have known the person that did this to her because she would have let her into the house. The house was, I guess, very secure. It was double gated. So it's likely that somebody came to the door. Ashley had just taken a shower. She was still in her robe. She let this person voluntarily inside. So when Ashton saw the news report that Ashley had been murdered, he immediately contacted police and was fully cooperative with the investigation because it was likely that he was the last person that had talked to her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he knows it's only a matter of time. He's going to be a suspect probably.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, yeah, you're supposed to go out with her this night and she ends up dead.
Right. So it was only after he learned the gruesome details about the case that he realized that when he looked through the window and saw what he thought was wine that had spilled, it was actually Ashley's blood that he had seen.
Wow.
So very chilling. So all of Ashley's previous boyfriends, including Ashton, had been eliminated as suspects when friends of hers came forward to tell police about a potential suspect. There was a man in the neighborhood that was giving Ashley an unhealthy amount of attention, that truly bordered on obsession. Hmm. And they were saying how Ashley was just such a social, fun person that her friend group was literally hundreds. So to go through how many people truly knew her was not an easy task.
Yeah.
So obviously they had to get to the bottom of who do you think would be capable of doing something like this? And that's where this person's, you know, presence came up. So however, Ashley, like I said, had a very large social circle. So they're weeding through this whole thing and they're talking to her friends about this guy. And at this point in time, they really only knew that his name was Mike. And you know, those Mikes, they can be very shady characters.
Very, yes. Like myself. Exactly. You're pointing at me.
So they knew his name was Mike and he was an air conditioning technician. They were unable to locate him because, again, this list was extensive. So they eventually did learn his full name. And oh, what do you know? It's Michael Gargiulo. He had moved to the area shortly after shortly after Ashley's murder. Ashley's former roommate, this is Justin Peterson, he had several disturbing interactions with Michael before Ashley's murder. In one instance, Justin confronted Michael when he was lurking around Ashley's house in the early morning hours, like 3 a.m. So Michael,
like lurking, like near the
hanging
house,
around, there was like a dog park nearby. So he was just very there. And you
clearly,
know,
clearly, like, you know, he's trying to look in her house or whatever, get a peek at her.
You get that vibe, that creep vibe. So, you know, Justin did not like the looks of this. So he went up to Michael to basically find out, what in the heck are you doing? Michael mentioned that he couldn't go home because the FBI was waiting for him to collect DNA samples about a murder case in Chicago.
He mentioned that?
He said this to Justin, and he's obviously referring to Trisha's case.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something I would probably bring up. I'd be like, oh, just hanging out, you know, or just say that the FBI's at my house, you know, looking for into a murder. Yeah.
So Justin asked Michael what he had to hide, and Michael pulled up his pant leg and unsheathed a jagged knife that had been strapped to his shin.
Whew, I'm glad you said knife instead of something else.
No. What did you think I was going to say?
Schlong? I don't know.
No.
Okay.
So Justin obviously was very uncomfortable with the situation. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. This guy's lurking about.
Three in the morning, a guy shows his knife that's being like looked at for murder. That's a bad situation.
So very quickly, Justin is rushing him away from the house.
Yeah.
So as this was happening, detectives in Los Angeles were contacted by investigators from Illinois who were investigating the cold case murder of Trisha Picaccio after they had learned that their one and only suspect had relocated to California in 1998.
Good.
The DNA results from Trisha's murder were now usable, and police hoped that they could match Michael to the crime. So he wasn't lying when he said that the FBI was trying to collect DNA.
Well, I don't know why he would just say that out of the blue.
I know.
So, I didn't expect him to be lying because that's a really stupid thing to say either way. And so 5 years later, the technology improved that much?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Well, they didn't take the DNA. I don't think it was like 2002, 2003. So about 10 years after Trisha's murder.
Okay.
So, you know, we're moving ahead a little bit here, but going back to the Picaccios, they received a phone call from a Hollywood homicide detective. Obviously, they're working with Cook County in Illinois. We're actually from that area, but they're not expecting a phone call from California about their daughter's case. So they got a bombshell dropped on them that in the fall of 2002, detectives from Illinois had flown to Los Angeles to collect DNA samples from Michael. And then in September of 2003, the results finally came back and the foreign DNA that was on Trisha's fingernails belonged to Michael. Mm. They're hearing this years later, not from their own detectives, but from detectives in California.
So their own local detectives weren't doing anything about it. And the California detectives came out.
Yes. Can you imagine hearing this information from detectives that are 2,000 miles away and completely unrelated to your daughter's case? Hey, 3 years ago, this matched Michael Gargiulo, who they all suspected had something to do with Trisha's murder. Can you imagine getting that phone call?
Man, I'd feel so like just at a loss, and I'd want to, if I was in contact with one of like the local police or local detectives, I'd want to go and step up their tires and like just ruin their lives. Be like, you could have had this information and you didn't do anything about it.
The most frustrating part about this is that Diane and Rick were relentless with the Cook County detectives. They were not like off the grid and not in contact. We're talking multiple times a week. Diane's there. At one point, Rick got a call, get your wife out of here. He said they refused to let her into the station. They're like, you wouldn't even treat a dog this way. And you're treating my wife this way, who lost her daughter in a murdered frenzy.
Yeah.
So there was clearly a ball was majorly dropped here.
Yeah.
For 3 years, they knew this, and the Picaccios did not know this.
Well, so, at least I'm sure that whoever was in charge there is probably just retired without any kind of suspension of pay or anything.
Yeah. And a lot of the detectives they worked with over the years have retired throughout the years because, again, this DNA didn't come back for 10 years after their daughter was murdered.
Man, when cops do a great job, mm-hmm. but when they sometimes do a bad job like this, that's just hurts so bad.
So when they did get the match that the DNA on the fingernail clippings of Trisha was a match for Michael, the evidence was handed over to the Illinois state's attorney, who determined that it was insufficient to issue an arrest warrant because they wanted corroborating evidence. They worried that it could be argued that because Trisha knew Michael, his DNA could have gotten onto her by casual contact.
Casual contact? It was probably under her fingernails, right?
It was her fingernail clippings, yes.
So how the hell is casual contact? How? Like, could they explain how casual contact? I guarantee I don't have anybody's DNA under my fingernails, except maybe yours. Like, maybe, mm-hmm. maybe.
Maybe, but probably right. not even. So just the day before Trisha was murdered, Michael and his friend were driving Michael's father's van. They saw Trisha walking. They stopped and Michael offered to drive her. She was heading to her boyfriend's house. So Michael's friend was in the passenger seat. This is Scott Olson. He insisted that there was no physical contact between Michael and Trisha that day. She got into the back seat of the van. She got out at her boyfriend's house. She never touched Michael. He said that I will testify to that fact that they didn't touch each other. And prosecutors remained unwilling to bring the charges despite this fact. And because of this, both murder cases were put on hold pending further developments.
I mean, it is one thing. You'd like to get something else, like the knife or
right.
something, you know.
So they were worried that they'd bring it to a jury and it wouldn't be enough.
Right.
So nothing was done, including telling the family. So in 2005 now, we're moving on to 32-year-old mother of four. This is Maria Bruno. She was struggling in life at this point in time as the year was coming to an end. The native of El Salvador had recently separated from her husband, Irving, and she had just really moved into this apartment. This is in El Monte, just east of LA, only weeks earlier at most, like maybe even a week and a half. She specifically chose this very building, an apartment, because it was considered very safe. It was in a gated complex, and before her separation, she and Irving had gotten into several violent fights that involved her husband, like closed fist, punching her in the face.
I can't stand that, man.
Really bad.
Yeah.
So as Maria was relocating to her new home, she's getting settled. So Irving had her four children. They were all under age five. So it was the night of December 1st, 2005, and Maria was asleep in her new apartment when a man slipped in through her kitchen window, grabbed a knife from the kitchen. And the next day, Maria was going to arrive to Irving's to get the kids. She didn't arrive. So Irving headed over to her apartment and was met with an absolutely horrifying scene. Maria had been mutilated in her own home, and the autopsy showed that she had been stabbed 17 times. In a sadistic act, the killer had removed Maria's breasts.
Oh my God.
They had removed one of her nipples and placed it over her mouth.
That's nuts, man.
Just that's so disturbing.
Deeply disturbing.
So whoever this monster is exceptionally disturbing.
Wow.
Despite the fact that it appeared that the murderer had covered their tracks, investigators did find a hospital-style booty discarded in the courtyard outside of Maria's apartment, and DNA was able to be recovered from this piece of evidence. So they did find a drop of blood on the sole of the booty, and this was a match to Maria, so they could tie it to this case. It wasn't like it was just unrelated random. And yeah. Sitting in the courtyard. It had her blood
on it. It
was
there, yeah.
So then they found out that obviously Irving is going to be a top suspect because they're going through a divorce.
Yeah.
There's documented records of this violence that they'd had in their marriage.
If I'm a cop and like picking this case, it's like, oh, this guy's a guilty. You know, you're thinking that before you even like get to anything.
Then on top of that, they find blood in Irving's car.
Oh my God. That guy's
that belonged to Maria.
If he doesn't get like in jail, I'd be very surprised.
So Irving told police that he and Maria had tried to rekindle the relationship. Obviously, they have four kids that are under age five. They actually had gone out to dinner earlier the evening that she was murdered. Maria at the restaurant cut her finger. So they went to the restaurant and spoke to the manager. He confirmed, yes, she was actively bleeding.
Thank God.
Yes. So they cleared Irving from the case, and now Maria's case grew cold.
I mean, not that Irving's a good guy.
But right. There was definitely some really bad things happening.
He made some mistakes.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So 3 years had gone by since Maria's murder, and now we're moving on to the night of April 28th, 2008. And 26-year-old Michelle Murphy had finished doing her laundry. She's at home. She went to sleep. So she's fallen asleep. All of a sudden, she's startled awake by a burning sensation in her arm and chest. Initially, she was confused as to what was happening. She thought she was just having a nightmare. And then she realized in horror that there was a man straddling her on her bed. This is like the thing that nightmares are made of. When are in your home asleep, you should feel safe.
Yeah, for sure.
And in all of these cases, these women were either on their doorstep stoop or in their homes.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously in Maria's case, she was asleep. Now we're moving on to Michelle, and she was asleep. So it was when she realized, like I said, this man is straddling her and had stabbed her in the arm. And that's the burning sensation that she felt. He was holding a large knife. Despite being only 5'1" and weighing 90 pounds, Michelle began fighting her attacker. She put up such a fight that she was able to catch him off guard. She began to punch, kick, and flail around like a wild animal, which allowed her to knock this knife-wielding lunatic off the bed and onto the floor. And when this happened, the assailant was stunned and uttered an apology before scurrying out into the night. So Michelle immediately called her boyfriend and he called 911, and the police phoned Michelle because they told her, you know, we're on our way, but in the meantime, they're going to get officers trying to find who did this to her. Mm-hmm. So she was able to tell them that her attacker was a man. He was wearing pants and a long sleeve type sweatshirt top. So because she had been sleeping, the room was dark and the description was very limited. She would guess that he stood about 5'11". So investigators saw that the assailant had gained access through a window that had been left open a few inches. Once inside, he opened the front door preemptively, knowing he would want to escape through that way. So then he entered the bedroom where Michelle was peacefully asleep and, you know, vulnerable and unaware. Detectives soon realized that the perpetrator had accidentally cut themselves before they made their escape, because police are arriving and they're seeing blood outside the home. Perfect. And like a trail of it.
Yeah.
So again, there's a trail of blood that started on the bed and it led out the front door that this person had preemptively opened. So Michelle had been stabbed 8 times in her chest, shoulder, and right arm.
Holy cow.
She had also suffered several wounds to her hands while she attempted to grab the blade of the knife. And that's ironic because our bonus episode on Wednesday involved an attack where the girl grabbed the knife blade too.
Yeah, I mean, if we're, God forbid, anybody's ever in that situation, it sounds like grabbing the knife is the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Even though it's going to cut you right away, like it gives you an opportunity.
So obviously there's a lot of blood on the scene. It's a mix between both her and this person. So she herself was bleeding profusely because she had been stabbed 8 times and then her hands were all cut up. So detectives entered the DNA from the blood they found at Michelle's home into the CODIS database. And 25 days later, they got a hit. And who do you think it matched to?
Old Mikey, the AC guy.
Old Mikey. Now he's 32 years old, Michael Gargiulo, because his DNA was already in the system from Trisha's case. Yeah. That's how they had it. So after Michelle vaulted Michael off her body, he fled through the front door. Again, he cut himself, so he's bleeding along the way. He ran toward an alley to an adjoining apartment complex. This was the apartment Michael had lived in since 2007 in a second floor unit that he shared with his wife, Anna Luz Gonzalez. The positioning of his unit was so close to Michelle's that had Michelle had the blinds of her bedroom open, he would have been able to see inside. So within 24 hours of this match, Michael was arrested in a Rite Aid parking lot on June 6, 2008 for the assault of Michelle Murphy.
Good.
When he was taken into custody, he asked the question, which agency is this? So what does that tell you?
He knows that he's wanted in probably several different areas and could be arrested by many different people.
Which means he likely has involvement in other problems.
Yep.
If he's not sure what this is related to.
Which one? What's this for?
Mm-hmm.
So, which one is this for?
The police at this moment in time are thinking there's got to be more victims out there because he's asking this question.
Interesting.
So they tracked where he had been living in various times that he was in California and discovered that he had lived only a few blocks away from Ashley Ellerin. And of course, we know they specifically mentioned him. Initially, they only knew that he was Mike and a heating and cooling guy, but then they did eventually get his name. So he's directly tied to that case as well as Maria Bruno when she was murdered in December of 2005. After Ashley had been murdered, Michael relocated to the gated apartment in El Monte where Maria lived. He lived close enough, just like Michelle, he lived close enough to Maria to also watch her. And she had even told her friends, despite the fact that she had only moved into the apartment maybe like a week and a half before, she had already voiced to her friends about interactions with, quote, the strange guy across the way. So she definitely picked up on his creep vibes and noticed him. So he was definitely watching her. Police were able to secure a search warrant for Michael's former residence after they discovered that he actually lived in the same apartment complex as Maria when she was killed. As they searched the location he previously lived in, they discovered another hospital-style booty hidden away in the attic of the apartment that matched the one that they found in the courtyard of Maria's complex with her blood on it. So that's a tie.
It's something.
So when the DNA from this booty was compared to the crime scene, both matched Michael.
Okay. Still need more.
As the investigation continued, detectives learned that Michael, who was 24 years old at the time that he attacked Ashley, when he first saw Ashley, because they were trying to figure out like where the relationship, what it was like, she was outside her home with her friend who had a flat tire. Her friend was changing the tire. She was basically standing there keeping her friend company. So up comes Michael bopping along, who's offering to help. And the friend who's changing the tire is like, kind of like, beat it. Like, I don't need your help.
Yeah, I got this.
So while Ashley's friend Chris was working on the tire, Michael was just chatting with Ashley and they exchanged numbers. It sounded more like he gave her a business card because he was in the heating and cooling business. Yeah. So, you know, she took it. He lived local. He lived about a block away from Ashley. Her friends remember him as a guy named Mike who continued to try to spend time with Ashley after meeting and often called her house. Eventually, he began showing up to her house without warning. One night, he walked into her house while she was hosting a party. He sat down and they immediately noticed that he was laser focused on Ashley. Creepy. Very creepy.
Gross.
Ashley, though, she was a beautiful, vivacious, outgoing girl. She caught the attention of many men during this time. She was certainly not interested in Michael. She was a nice, friendly person who probably had the mentality of the more the merrier.
Sure.
So her friends were looking at this guy like, don't trust him.
Sure.
So he definitely had that creep vibe. So 3 months after his arrest for the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy, Michael was formally charged now with the capital murders of Maria Bruno and Ashley Ellerin.
Okay.
So by this point, Michael was the father of two. He had been dubbed the Thriller Killer as well as the Hollywood Ripper.
So stupid. Thriller Killer. Like, this, it's just for news agencies to have something to do. And also Ripper. Like, where'd Ripper come from?
Like, think about Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, I know. I heard of him, but like, what is Ripper? Like, ripping people? Like, that's such a stupid thing. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. We have to have these names for everything. I guess it makes it a little more salacious.
He had like a handful of different names. The one that was used most commonly was a Hollywood Ripper. So he maintained, though, that he had been falsely accused despite all the concrete evidence against him. So while in prison awaiting trial, Michael allegedly told one of his fellow prisoners that the fact that his DNA was found at the crime scenes did not mean that he had killed 10 women involved.
Oh.
So the point of that is that he is only being charged with two murders. If you think about this guy and what a psychopath he is it possible that there are other victims that we just don't know about?
Oh, absolutely. Especially with how he killed Maria Bruno and just like diced her up and all that sick stuff he did.
100%. That is somebody that is comfortable with doing something this horrific.
Yeah, like he's having fun kind of.
Yeah. So gross. The years that we know of was 1993, 2001, 2005, and 2008. Did he really wait those spans of time before finding another victim? I don't buy
it.
I would bet that there's other victims that we just don't know. So while in prison and awaiting trial, Michael's day in court, and this is kind of crazy, it did not come until almost 9 years later.
Wow.
Until 2019, May 2nd to be specific. So this was delayed because of years of pretrial hearings, legal issues, and postponements. Many of the delays were a result of Michael because he was changing attorneys several times, and for about 3 years, he even represented himself. The California murders attracted mass global attention because it was attached to celebrity Ashton Kutcher. Mm-hmm. And of course, when he knew Ashley, he had only been involved in that 70s show for a few years. So he was up and coming in 2001. By 2019, everybody knows him.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of media attention associated with this case because of Ashton Kutcher. So Ashton Kutcher had taken the stand to recount the events of the fateful night of February of 2001, 18 years earlier. Ashton's testimony was very, very important because it solidified the timeline for the night that Ashley was murdered. And the window of opportunity was actually very, very narrow once they got all the details. So this made investigators believe that the person must have been watching because the timeline was so tight. So in Ashley's case, despite investigators scouring the crime scene, I mean, it was brutal, that crime scene, because she had been stabbed, what did I say, 47 times?
Yes.
It was a disaster.
No doubt.
But there was zero physical evidence that linked Michael to the case.
That's the big thing here. They don't have that. And I mean, they have the booties, but that doesn't have him stabbing her. You know, you can probably get something. It's going to be interesting to see what they get him on.
So there was no DNA. There were no eyewitnesses. There were no fingerprints whatsoever that said Michael was responsible for this. So Ashton said that when he called Ashley to iron out plans that night, she sounded upbeat. She showed no signs that she was in any kind of distress or danger.
So like totally fine. It's like they wanted to pinpoint exactly when it happened.
Right. And we can even pinpoint it further because we have a second witness here. The manager of Ashley's rental house was an aspiring actor as well. This is Mark Durbin. He was having an affair with Ashley at the time. He just so happened to be at the house when Ashton called at 8:24. Ashley and Mark had actually been intimate that very evening. She's a 22-year-old single girl.
Yeah,
hey, girl, go ahead. Do what you got to do. So again, she's got him there at the house. Ashton calls. He can verify that fact. And then phone records prove that it was at exactly 8:24 that he called. So when Ashton called, this is when Mark left. Then there's a neighbor who testified, because I believe it was the dog park that was directly across the street from where Ashley's bungalow was. He had entered the dog park and heard a shrill scream. He heard it twice and then all was quiet. That was 8:25 to 8:30. So we're talking a matter of like 5-6 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like as she hung up the phone with Ashton, Mark was already probably out the door.
Like, boom, hung up the phone. He's out the door. Boom, murder.
Like almost instantaneous.
So he was in there already.
Well,
probably.
What I'm guessing is she took the phone call, which with Ashton probably lasted maybe a minute. Sure. Oh, you know, I'm going to be running late. Yada, yada. Okay, bye, Mark. See ya. And then maybe there was a knock at the door after Mark had left.
Right.
Like within 2-3 minutes.
Yeah.
So she probably let him in. She had just finished taking a shower, and Mark confirmed this. Yes, she had taken a shower, and that's when he would have made his attack. So a bit more than an hour later, Ashton called Ashley again. He basically kept pushing off their plans because he was running late.
Mm-hmm.
This time she didn't answer, and she wouldn't have answered because she was already sadly deceased at that time.
Yeah.
So the call went to voicemail. He made the assumption that she was likely occupied. He headed over regardless. When she didn't answer the door, he never suspected that anything was amiss. He left Ashley's. He went about his own evening. Ashton did admit that when he learned that Ashley had been murdered, he was freaking out. He had tried the handle of her home. When she didn't answer, he knew his fingerprints were right there on the doorknob.
Sure.
So detectives were like, you have a solid alibi. He was hanging out with people. I think they were at like a Grammy watch party or something. They're like, you're fine. You're not a suspect. We need you for this, you know, testimony.
Sure.
So Michael's lawyer did not allow him to take the stand, despite the fact that he was absolutely chomping at the bit to do so. Because of his unpredictable behavior, he had a temper, he was likely to fly off the handle. They could not trust that he was going to keep his wits about him while he was being questioned, so they did not allow him to testify in his own defense.
I mean, definitely a good move on their part.
So during the testimony about Maria Bruno's murder, the prosecution argued that based on the pattern of blood, the killer was left-handed, just like Michelle's attacker was, and just like Michael Gargiulo was. He was left-handed.
Ah, that helps a little bit.
So in this attack, he left the booty behind. His DNA was found around the elastic band of the booty. Her blood was at the bottom of it. So
he was there.
Yes.
That's a good get.
However, the defense is arguing that Maria's estranged husband, Irving, was the murderer since they had a fractured marriage with known violence within it.
Sure.
The two rekindled their relationship that very night. He was the last known person with her on the night that she was murdered. After they had dinner, they were intimate, and then he left. A neighbor said that he heard crying at about 1:30 a.m., and all these people, they hear things, but I guess nobody calls. Like the guy in the dog park heard a woman screaming twice.
Yeah.
They never called.
We've never heard anything. We've heard gunshots in our area. Never heard, you know, called.
We have like a shooting range somewhere nearby.
No, it's just hillbillies.
Or hillbillies too.
Yeah.
So in regards to the discarded booty, with the drop of Maria's blood on it and Michael's DNA around the elastic band, the defense reminded the jury that Michael lived across the courtyard. He was a repairman. He was known to wear booties for his line of work. So what they're saying is, yeah, the booty was there, and we can't dispute the evidence that was there. One had likely fallen out of his pocket when he was coming home from work. He had picked up it. So when it dropped, it would have picked up Maria's blood, which was already outside. So that's how they said that that was. They explained that away. Mm-hmm. So when Trisha's case was discussed and the fact that Michael's DNA was on Trisha's fingernails, the defense reinforced that she was in his van just the day before. However, a forensic expert at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, this is Nathan Lentz, he was asked if it's likely that just simply sitting in a car would be enough to pick up DNA and keep it on a body for 24 to 36 hours.
No way.
So this would be a case of secondary transfer, and he had never seen secondary transfer that lasted that long, since there aren't enough cells that would survive, especially on your hands. Our hands are touching things all day long. Hopefully, we're frequently washing our hands. So the odds of her having his DNA under her fingernails just for sitting in his van 24 to 36 hours later is basically not possible. So the other significance of this is that the mixture on her fingernails was a 50-50 match between herself and Michael. This is significant because a 50-50 mixture normally means that there was a lot of DNA that requires extensive contact.
Yeah, like scraping down their hands and
yes.
stuff.
Yes, so that kind of mixture that you would see is from direct contact, directly scraping your nails down someone. And again, his friend who was in the van with him when they did give Trisha the ride home said he never saw them touch. She got in the back, she got out. Mm-hmm. So that's just not going to happen. So Michelle Murphy took the stand to testify. She described how she wrapped her hands around the blade of the knife as she was startled awake by the stabbing. And at some point, she was able to get her legs against his chest and basically launch him off the bed. She described how she chased him out of the room and down the hallway as he told her, "I'm sorry," before slipping out the front door. She never saw his face because it was dark, but she did confirm he was left-handed. In Michelle Murphy's case, there's no refuting the DNA evidence. This is the case where he cut himself.
Yeah, absolutely.
His DNA was all over her home after she managed to fight him off. The courtroom was surprised when Michael's attorneys did not deny the fact that he was the one that attacked Michelle, but insisted that it was because he was not in his right mind when he did it, and it was as if another personality had taken over, as if he was possessed. Two mental health experts were called in, and it was claimed that Michael suffered from dissociative identity disorder, which is formerly known as multiple personality disorder. So they're arguing that it wasn't him that did this.
His other personality.
Right. So the trial lasted 3 months. It called 79 witnesses to the stand.
Wow.
And after a 3.5 day deliberation, on the day of August 15th, 2019, Michael Gargiulo was found guilty and convicted of capital murders of Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno, in addition to the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy, the only known survivor.
What about Trisha?
We'll get there. So Michael is listening to this verdict. He sat there. He had not an ounce of emotion. So then the penalty phase began on October 7th, 2019, and Michael's teenage son took the stand and begged for his father's life. The jury members did sympathize with this boy because obviously it's not his fault that his father is an absolute monster.
Right.
But, you know, they felt very compelled to sentence this man to death. So because of additional delays, the sentencing wasn't held for another 2 years. We're talking his last known murder was in 2008. This sentencing didn't happen until July 16th, 2021.
It's crazy.
Crazy.
I mean, he's being held in the meantime, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, literally just a few years ago. So a judge agreed and Michael was sentenced to death by lethal injection. When the judge gave Michael the sentence in LA, family members of his victims wept. Michelle Murphy broke down and told the court how spending the night alone creates a world of fear in me more than a decade later. So she is exceptionally fearful to be alone, especially at night.
Well, sure, because she woke up and there was a guy actively stabbing her. How the hell she got out of that? I have no idea. But
man, I mean, just sheer adrenaline. And I mean, thank goodness, like you just said. So Trisha's parents were contacted right away about the news and told that it was now their turn to get justice. Her case was only included in the California trial as supporting evidence. It was not part of the trial, just basically to give evidence about Michael's criminal pattern. Mm-hmm. As he remained in San Quentin awaiting an execution date, Illinois authorities worked to extradite him to Chicago, to stand trial for Trisha's murder. Her family members remain cautiously optimistic since they have been let down tremendously by Cook County State's Attorney Office and have really criticized the office for being slow to charge Michael for anything.
Yeah, good job.
Despite the DNA match, very poor communication with them, which is very sad. I mean, this is their daughter. They need justice for her death.
I mean, I totally understand that police, you know, go through a lot of trauma. They see it every day almost, you know, hopefully not super, super often. And it's their job. And it's like kind of gets, you know, it's not like the, you know, they don't understand. They understand it, but they don't treat it sometimes like it's the worst day in all these people's lives because they see it literally every day. So it's like, you know, they're desensitized.
Like what if it was your daughter kind of case?
Yeah.
So in 2011, 48 Hours reported on Trisha's case. And after this was televised, a witness came forward with reports that they worked with Michael as a bouncer in the late 1990s at a Hollywood nightclub. And one day while he and another man were driving around with Michael, Michael confessed to killing a girl in Illinois.
Nice.
And he specifically said, yeah, I buried a bee. I left the bee on the steps for dead.
Nice.
Real nice guy.
Well, I mean, that's good. Yes. Good that he said it.
So he specifically told these two guys while they were driving around that he had stabbed the girl to death.
Awesome.
So 48 Hours put the two witnesses in touch with Chicago authorities shortly after.
Beautiful.
And they ended up being key witnesses at Michael's LA trial. Because again, they're just like trying to reinforce what kind of guy this is. So each of the members of Trisha's family were also there to testify in the LA trials and recall the horrific details of the morning that Trisha was found mutilated on the stoop of their own home. It's not lost on Trisha's family that had something been done in 2003 when they found that the DNA under Trisha's nails was a match for Michael, that Maria Bruno would still be alive and Michelle would not be suffering from the trauma of being attacked in her own home because he would have been behind bars before he had an opportunity to do that.
Right.
Obviously, Ashley was murdered in 2001. They didn't know the details until 2 years later. So Michael continues to maintain his innocence, and his motives for this brutal crime, they're really not clear. Though there were no signs of sexual assault in any of these cases, it's still believed that these murders were sexually motivated. It was theorized that he received sexual gratification from the act of stabbing his victims in what actually has a name. It's known as a behavior that's a sadistic behavior, obviously, called pickerism. Hmm. This is defined as sexual interest in penetrating the skin of another person with a sharp object.
Wow.
Isn't it disturbing that we've even had to name that trait? Yeah,
that means there's been more than one person that's been into that.
So Michael had attacked four young, attractive, outgoing women just for the thrill of it. He stalked them out, he staked them out, and then he made his attack with a knife in and around their homes between the years of 1993 until his arrest in 2008.
Scumbag.
After suddenly waking from sleep within the safety of her own home, Michelle was able to fight off her attacker. Despite surviving the attack, her emotional scars remain, and she has become paralyzed with the idea of being alone, especially after dark. She has also felt the feeling of survivor's guilt, like these other three women lost their lives, but she has managed to slowly begin the long road of healing to this day.
Yeah.
Michael's execution likely won't happen anytime soon. The last execution in California was in 2006, and the practice has been banned since 2019 under Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. There are currently 650 individuals on California's death row, and this is the largest in the Western Hemisphere. On the surface, Michael Gargiulo gave the appearance of being a friendly neighbor with pure intentions. Under this innocent facade lived a monster who lurked in the dark and stole the lives and safety from innocent women. He was a violent man towards women specifically, interested in serial killer Ted Bundy, and studied forensic science. And obviously, he knew what he was doing, because you look at Ashley's case and there was no DNA at all, no fingerprints at all. Had he not cut himself in Michelle's case, odds are he would have not at all been linked to that.
Yep.
Exactly. So he learned from other killers' mistakes. He studied a book that explained how to kill with a knife. This is the Anarchist Cookbook, which
I have that.
That's kind of weird. Did you read it?
I mean, not front to back, but there are some interesting things in
there. So it tells you how to kill a person with a knife?
I didn't read that section. I did read the pipe bomb section, though.
Okay. It seems like a bad idea.
Well, I mean, you know, curious. It's just, you know.
I'm going to sleep with one eye open next to you, you psychopath.
I'm not going
to
suggest people go read it, but I mean, it was a big thing in the, like, when the internet first started up, it was kind of like, oh, do you have the Anarchist Cookbook? Because, like, yeah, I've got the text file, the TXT.
And
it was a gigantic file, and you could find basically anything you wanted to do that was bad. Like, it would all be, I never thought about murder. I thought about bombs.
Oh, okay.
Not that I wanted to kill anybody. Like, I was just curious. I was like, how do you make a pipe
bomb?
Yeah.
I have actually heard of that book. So this year will be 31 years since Trisha was brutally murdered, and her parents still wait for justice. Diane Picaccio said that Trisha was always so helpful to others. She was a truly remarkable, tremendous girl, and she deserves the justice that she has yet to get. And that is the sad and tragic case of the Hollywood Ripper.
Justice being like, you know, going to trial and saying
yes,
guilty.
Yes, absolutely.
Her murder.
Yes. Is he going to be behind bars for the rest of his life? Of course. They want it to be that, yes, this Michael Gargiulo did this to our daughter.
You know, it would suck if he like gets a not guilty or something, or gets off on some way that they obtained evidence or something like that.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
I don't even know if he'd be able to get a fair trial, because everybody would already know everything.
But, yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's in jail for the rest of his life, and it sucks for his kids. If I'm his kids, you got to watch out for this multiple personality disorder too in yourself, because God knows what will happen. I mean, he procreated, so
yeah, it's
some of
scary.
His genes are out there. Very scary. Well, I'm so sorry to all the women, the victims in the story, dead and alive.
I mean, it's like truly from a scene from a horror movie. Everything that happened in these cases, it's just so sad when you're supposed to feel safe in your own home.
Yep.
And all of these happened either on the doorstep or in the home. And it's just so scary.
Yep, absolutely. So thank you all so much for listening. We really appreciate it. You know, if you have a couple extra bucks, you know, maybe it's payday week for you, and you're like, wow, this couple, Allison, puts in so much effort and work and research into these cases, and we truly care, because we actually do. It really sucks bringing these stories to you. It's important that these people's stories are heard, and that we can look out for things that are similar, you know, just so it doesn't happen again. Yeah, hopefully. I obviously, there's plenty of stories for us here to choose from, but
absolutely,
you know, if it sparks somebody's brain and, you know, they cannot be one of these stories, then that's fantastic. You know, these people wouldn't have died in vain. So if you believe in us, then, you know, head on over to Patreon, look at our show notes or Apple subscriptions. Toss us a few shekels. This is just a little mom and pop podcast. I'm Pa.
And I'm Ma.
Yeah. So we'd like to say welcome to the Crime and Coffee Couple Club, to the latest members, Michelle, Elizabeth, Risa, Rachel, Montana, Susan, and Teril. I looked it up before I did it. I think that's how you say it. So
all beautiful names.
Yes, all very, very nice. So thank you so much for your patronage, your Apple subscription, all that good stuff. And yeah, we appreciate each and every one of you for listening, right?
Yes, we do. Absolutely. And if you are a bonus member or part of the Crime and Coffee Club, we will be back on Wednesday with a bonus episode, and then back again the following Sunday. So thank you guys so much for being here with us. We appreciate each and every one of you. And until next time, bye.